If you want freedom from the man, you have to be sure that your definition of freedom isn't one the man made up. Yes, there are a lot of questions about what it means to have sovereignty in this world, and perhaps somebody who has synthesized spirituality and science to point us to the grand illusion, i.e., what is reality in life itself, can give us answers. You're free to listen to any podcast you want, but if you want answers, well, it might be fortune and fate that led you to this mind-blowing episode with Brendan Murphy on Open Loops. Hello, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome. It's your favorite late-night talk show for the shamelessly fringe. Open Loops with Greg Bornstein, Conversations That Bend. I'm your host, Greg Bornstein, consciousness disruptor, cultural hypnotist, curator of experience. And hold on tight, I'm your chief looper. How about that for a very straightforward intro? Will I no longer be a looper one day? Will I go straight on ya? Don't read into that. I know I'm in theater. There's a joke, but it's all good. I'm coming at you with a very different mood this week. A little more relaxed, a little more welcome to the lounge kind of feel. This show is always about that, though. I mean, part of it is because of how wacky the things are that we talk about sometimes. Aliens, time travel, hypnosis, magic, the esoteric, the taboo, the supernatural, the paranormal, the abstract, the metaphysical, the philosophical, the psychoanalytical, and of course, the deepest questions of them all, who and what we really are. Yes, it's that theme park for your intellect and imagination, a place where I am challenging your existing beliefs with radically unique ideas designed to stimulate your unconscious mind and allow you to step into the highest version of yourself. It's a big mission. It's a big mission, you know? Gonna make it happen, gonna, you know, someone has to do it. My guest today, Brendan Murphy, author of The Grand Illusion. He is also a consciousness disruptor. I mean, this guy has a podcast that absolutely welcomes challenging viewpoints. I love it. And this man spent many years synthesizing his thoughts about spirit science into one unified field theory of absolute smoke and mirrors. I love that. You know, sometimes I think that maybe my love of magic, and I mean traditional close-up card magic, what I was doing at birthday parties when I was five, that obsession with illusions relates to the metaphysical world even more so than I realized. I used to think they were diametrically opposed. I used to think that because I see the world as an illusion, or at least magic tricks are this mechanical thing that looks like something else, that more so supported the scientific view, i.e. God, right? Atheists, the way we break down God. I'm in myself an atheist in that moment. I didn't, Oh, did I let the secret out? No. The way you're the atheist listener. Yeah, be as godless as possible. You know, I like heathens as my top Apple Podcast demographic. No. What I was gonna say is that you, if you are an atheist, you basically can rationalize all the mystery of life by saying, I don't know, and that they're scientific process, they're natural processes we don't know yet that explain. But you can look at evolution and point out all these things, and it points to that things are natural, and there's no need to bring magic in there, this magical figure. Very much believe that for a long time. I talk about it all the time on this show. But that's kind of the magic trick view that, oh, well, God is the box, but the science is the mechanisms inside the box, and scientists are opening up the box to realize where the woman hides her legs when she's cut in half. Interesting perspective. That's one angle. And by the way, I was not cutting women in half when I was doing my magic all the way from elementary school, preschool through high school. I never had a female ever. Period. No, I didn't have a woman that was ready to go inside a box and get cut in half for me, like all the other cool magicians did. Lame. But no, I just never actually did that kind of grand illusion thing, but it's part of the metaphor. Now, the other perspective, which I find more interesting, is the grand illusion as a spiritual principle. This idea that what we see is reality, and this is where the science and spirituality thing gets interesting, because a lot of people look at quantum physics and probabilities in the world, and they say, well, that's a magical idea. This notion that matter isn't even solid. It's every second is a possible version of the reality we're creating, because consciousness is creating everything. And of course it's not just, it's either consciousness or matter, but this play between, in a way, our collective consciousness might be manifesting every single sight and perspective and thing we're seeing moment to moment in this reality in order to make sense and meaning of the world. And the idea that we're doing that from this intelligence is an amazing magic trick. It's not even a magic trick. It is magic in the more traditional definition. Nothing here is solid. It is a act of creation as it's being lived, like a dream, as Leo DiCaprio experiences in Inception, or describes to Elliot Page's character in Inception. The waking dream, that's the illusion, the grand illusion. No wonder I was interested in magic, because it parallels exactly what we're doing. It's just a microcosm version of it. It's humans' closest attempt to, in a demonstrative artistic way, showcase our ability to do what can't be explained by rational thought. It's a copy of a copy of a copy. Perhaps being a magician is kind of a much cheaper version of all this, but it's the Plato's cave for this grand intelligence's universal agenda. Copy and a copy and a copy and a copy. So at the end of the day, does that mean that magicians, i.e. people that do card tricks, are really the real gods? Have I personally gone on first dates and brought a deck of cards knowing that at some level it was gonna impress the woman? Shamefully, yes, I have. And now that confession is over, does a podcaster blush sometimes? I'm not sure. I'm not sure I'm capable of coloration on my face. Wow. Yeah, I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer yet, but what I suppose I'm putting out there is this draw towards the elusive is perhaps because I'm seeking to understand the nature of reality itself. Being a magician, I've never made that connection. It's not just science and playing around. There's something more meaningful going on here. And I'm determined to find it. Luckily, we have my guest, Brendan Murphy. Now, he is the host of Truthyverse, which goes into all sorts of really mind-blowing areas. Also, he wrote this book, like I said, book one. He has three volumes in him already. I mean, this guy does a lot. He teaches DNA activation, works with small groups to heighten their awareness. He has well, what is it called? Oh yes, Truth. Dot network. I just knew the spelling was weirder. Trooth dot network, which is a censorship-free Facebook alternative. He's a consciousness disruptor. He's on the forefront of that. In this episode, we go into his journey as well as his understanding of what science and spirituality synthesized is like. Yes, you want to understand the laws of the universe? Well, one of the best ways you can do it is make sure you like and subscribe to the Open Loops YouTube channel, as well as this podcast. Follow it on Apple Podcasts. And if you can, rate the show and leave a review. That helps get this content out there so much more. I'd greatly, greatly appreciate it. This is a fun one. Here he is, Freedom Hacker, Brendan Murphy. Today on Open Loops, we have Brendan Murphy, author and host of the Truthiverse podcast, as well as the author of The Grand Illusion, a synthesis of science and spirituality, book one, and co-founder of the censorship-free Facebook alternative, Truth, that's Trooth dot network. His work is designed to push humanity and civilization to greater consciousness, freedom, and health. He calls himself a freedom hacker. I'm excited to go into all of it. Brendan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Unmute myself. Thanks, Greg. Good to be here, man.
Oh, all good. All good. Hey, look, I'm very curious. Freedom hacker. What do you mean by that phrase?
Yeah, it's kind of I guess freedom, it's kind of the through line. Truth and freedom are the two biggest sort of driving forces for me, and I'm all about just being able to live in the world in the way that you want to, unencumbered, uninhibited, you know, without any impositions from external forces or authorities. And you know, that's easier said than done in the world that we live in. So, you know, I value freedom very highly, and it's a lifelong challenge, I think, to actually embody that and live it.
Yeah. What do you think? I mean, is 'cause some people would go for the freedom hacker label and might just be like teaching how to start their six-figure online course business. Which, not to say that's not a great idea, because when you have these consciousness ideas, it's there's a lot to teach, and there's only so much you can get out, as just here, you know, in a podcast, you can really dive in deeper. But I am curious. Did your synthesis of spirituality, this understanding about consciousness and the grand illusion, was that something that led you to really pursuing truth and freedom, or did the first part happen and then you came into the spiritual understanding? How did it work for you?
I think I was kind of always predisposed to be a bit curious and a little bit sort of gravitating towards the fringe. And so when the fire kind of got lit in me, it was pursuit of truth. You know, what is the absolute ultimate truth? What's going on here? What is reality? What is consciousness? What are we? What are we doing here? And then freedom, you know, ties in with that. I don't think you can really be free, at least in the way I conceive of it, if you don't have awareness, self-awareness and knowledge of truth, because if you don't have that, then you're operating inside of illusions and little boxes, little fabricated sort of prisons for the mind. And then you can't see that you're free.
Yeah. What was it? Do you remember one of the early mind prisons you identified that set you on this journey?
Yeah. I mean, one of the major ones that we're still getting over is, I would say, you know, the religious structure. And, you know, when I was a kid, I had a certain amount of indoctrination, you know, we're at an age where you don't know any better and you don't have any discernment. You know, you believe in Santa and the Easter Bunny, so you believe whatever else they tell you. So it's like, yeah, I had that for a little while. And then, you know, through, as I got into sort of mid-teens, it started to fade away, started to let go of that. And, you know, you open your mind and you start thinking things through a little bit. And it's like, oh, okay, there's something more to this. This is a little bit simplistic.
Yeah. Did you use it when you say, I mean, look, I'm similar in the sense that the fringe has always intrigued me, and the fact that it even exists as a category of events and things in the world makes me at least entertain it. Did you have any kind of fringe or paranormal experiences early on too? And if so, what were they?
Early, I can't think of any from early on. I definitely started having plenty from, you know, the age of 20 onwards. And, you know, that was like, that coincided with me actually waking up and having the awareness kicking in of, you know, what's what and who we really are, what we fundamentally are. And then, yeah, I had a lot of interesting experiences following on from that, you know, experiences with presences in the room, energy, vortexes of energy in the room, and seeing lights and whatever, you know, whatever else type of stuff. And, you know, so I've had certain things go on, certain paranormal types of events along the way. But that only happened after I kind of had that revelation, that epiphany, and was already consciously pursuing, you know, the path.
Wow, what is this? I want to dig into this epiphany. What it sounds cool to have an epiphany. It sounds great to have an awakening. I know some people, you know, it's spontaneous. Sometimes it can be, you know, ayahuasca induced or any of the variety medicinal plants. You know, what was your moment, or was it a series? I'm curious how that developed for you.
Yeah, I have to thank my brother really, because he was still at school and I was out of school. He's 3 years younger than me. And he came home one day and said, yeah, we had this guy come in. He was a young entrepreneur. He was talking about his, you know, he was supposed to talk about business, but he kept talking about this book that he found really interesting. And I think you might be interested in this book. And so I made a mental note of this, the name of the book. And I was like, I sat on it for about 6 months. And, you know, 6 months later, I finally had the psychological momentum to go, okay, I need to read this thing now. At that point in time, it was like my life was poised perfectly for me to have that download. And so I went and read this book. And it turns out, and you may have heard of it, a lot of people have, it's called The Holographic Universe. And it completely blew my mind. I mean, it showed me how utterly clueless I was about how things work and what is possible and what we are. And it destroyed all of my kind of existing ideas about that, or my limitations, my limiting ideas around what we are and what's reality. So from that moment onwards, I was just absolutely just possessed. I was a man possessed, and I had to know more. And I had started to have those types of experiences, you know, mystical experiences where you come into contact. I had experiences of infinite consciousness, and that solidified the learnings, the intellectual level of learnings that I had been, you know, receiving through books like The Holographic Universe, which started me down that path. So once I had
such a good book. Yeah,
it's fantastic. It really is. I mean, I can't recommend it enough. I kind of ended up writing an updated version of it, you know, like 20 years down the track. So that's kind of what the Grand Illusion is.
That's awesome. No, I mean, look, what's interesting about The Holographic Universe is that I think I was going into it looking for another interesting. I mean, look, in high school, I was very into theoretical physics, and just and as somebody that is interested in time travel, you know, understanding why we can or cannot, according to the laws of physics as defined by mainstream Western science, why or why not we can or cannot build a time machine, go back in time, experience teleportation, all these things. So I was reading a lot, read a lot of Stephen Hawking and Brian Greene, and these big names, and I was always intrigued by it. And then the holographic universe came across, and I just said, whoa, this is interesting, because it builds off of, I mean, David Bohm's work and a lot of the uncertainty principle and Schrodinger's cat and all these things that are I suppose the esoteric side, quote unquote, of theoretical physics. But highly recommend this book, Michael I believe it's Talbot, Michael Talbot's work. I think what hooked me about it was that it said, and this is going to explain things like paranormal phenomenon and all these other aspects of life. And then you actually sit down and read it, and there's stuff about, I mean, Sai Baba and manifestation and people looking at churches and seeing Mary floating above the church. And there were just things in that book, Brendan, that made me go, what is going on here? How can a book that's so grounded in scientific thought also be open to the idea of these other things floating around? And it didn't necessarily mean I was convinced, but I'm curious for you in your journey. What was it about that book that opened the doorway beyond just living in the rational understanding so that you could experience more?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I think it was key for me to have the realization of, or the, my version of possibility opened up massively. That was really the key for them being able to have, from having an open mind to then have expanded experiences of consciousness. So, yeah, that was key, because you can't have an experience of infinity if you're stuck in a little mental box that says, I'm just a meat sack, and there's nothing more to the world than the material world that I can perceive. Like that prevents you. That mindset is very limiting. So you can't have those types of experiences if you're stuck in that box. And then, of course, it's self-fulfilling prophecy. Whatever you believe becomes your experience. So you think that your beliefs are valid because your experience bears it out. And it just opened up a whole new vista of potential experiences for me. And then I had stuff that anchored in, okay, here's what's possible. And like you said, he grounded it in science, in scientific concepts on the leading edge of the day. And it's still relevant now. It's still massively relevant. But because he was open-minded himself, he did a brilliant job of bringing in those weird, esoteric, paranormal things and saying, hey, this is actually how this relates to these physics principles and concepts here. And this is, he helped to legitimize what was typically seen by people who think of themselves as having a scientific mentality as being, taboo and anathema, and you don't talk about that because you destroy your credibility type thing. But he helped to give it credibility, which was a huge step in the right direction. He really did something very, very valuable.
Yeah. So is it that simple then for people that are, and I know you teach a course. I mean, you even have a free course called Evolve Yourself, to learn about, DNA activation and healing work, which, if anything, it is related to this. And I know you have like a self-gnosis membership where people can delve into these things and experience these things yourself. But I am curious in terms of like the turnaround time from, well, I'm an atheist or agnostic that's open-minded to, I want to experience something. I know this is a little bit of my ego mind kicking in here. It always happens. But I'm curious, like, what do you think? How easy is it? How quick could somebody, if they had the intention to say, I want to experience the multidimensionality of the universe, to start to experience that?
Pretty quickly. I mean, in principle, really quickly. If you don't have the limiting beliefs blocking that out, then you can do it. In principle, you could just sit there and close your eyes right now and meditate yourself into an altered state. And, I mean, I think an easier way for people is to go on, take a hallucinogen like 5-MeO DMT or something. But so that's an option too. Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah, no. That's good. It's good. It's good. And yeah, and I agree. I think that is something that in my time interviewing people on the show, they've said, yeah, but have you ever, had faith it would work, or have you ever actually set the intention to want it? You have to decide that you can contact an alien before you're going to start going out there and meditating and trying to connect with these people. You kind of it is intention is such a huge part of it. What do you make of that? What do you make of like the human? I'm curious your understanding of consciousness and the role that setting intention has. in your life?
Okay. Resetting intention in your life. Yeah. Well, I think it's just a given to me that you need to live intentionally. Like a lot of people don't, you know, and that's a large part of our problem is the intentional part of the brain is the prefrontal lobe. It's the most advanced part of the brain and the most highly evolved. It's connected to all the other parts of the brain, the primitive bits. And if you're not living intentionally, that part behind the forehead is basically asleep. Which means you're basically asleep. You're basically walking around in autopilot mode, and you're not really thinking things through. You're not acting intentionally, which is a huge problem. Like this is a plague on the planet right now. So for me, I just value that very highly. I value intentionality very highly. And I see and appreciate in people when they live like that. You know, you can see it, it's obvious. And then most people don't. They live as their programming, the external programming around them dictates that they should live. And then they just follow the program, sleepwalking around the place. And that's why we are in the mess that we're in. And that's how we experienced the mess of the last 2 years. It's that lack of intentionality, the lack of self-awareness breeds all these other problems.
That's so interesting. Yeah, it makes me even think about what you were saying about religion and God. And, you know, I know that some people talk about like the Godhead or developing Christ consciousness. And yeah, I mean, for people that sit around in church all day, it's kind of a step up to be like, hey, you know, God decided in these books to say, I'm going to create light, and did. That's intention. So then why are you his product? Did God ever say, and you will be my sheep? Well, some of those books say that, but it's like, it's kind of giving people choice and having the choice to make whatever you want of your lives in a powerful way is not something that is stressed in those mainstream religions. In a way, there is this kind of subservient, like, and there's something, someone above you always that has more powers than you. What do you think of that?
I'm glad you raised that, man, because especially in Christianity in particular, there's an undercurrent of sort of disapproval of the individual and the individual's choice and free will. And what they've done, and I've seen just recently, Amy shared, she's found a comment by somebody who used to be a Bible bashing believer. And they explained to their audience the impact of the Genesis story about the snake in the garden and the deception, you know, eating the forbidden fruit. And the way that they, Christians, are basically more or less inculcated to perceive and interpret this story is that, you know, it's man's free will is the problem. Having your own, making your own decisions is the problem. What you're really supposed to do is mindlessly obey the Lord, which for them means, practically speaking, it means blindly believe what is your exoteric literalist interpretation of the holy book. You're submerging, you're sublimating your own free will and intentionality, and you're basically turning off your prefrontal lobe in a sense, so that you are now subordinate, and you become one of these sheep who is afraid of themselves, because they learned that, well, original sin, you know, we're all evil, we're all sinners, we can't make the right choice, so we just have to do what God tells us, kind of thing. And this is the way that a lot of people, if only subconsciously, are living right now. It's quite bizarre to me, and a massive waste of intelligence and creativity and brain power.
Yeah. And I wanted to mention, for you mentioned Amy. This is Amy Devlin, who co-founded, she worked with you on the Truth Network, but also the Global Freedom Movement. How did you come in contact with Amy and start all the projects that you've been involved with?
Well, funnily enough, she actually found my book before she found me.
When did you write this book? When did the book come out?
Published at 2012, so 10 years ago almost, yeah.
12, and how far along in your personal journey of awakening did you get that book out?
I was approaching the 10-year mark at that point.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So back to Amy, and we're going to get into the book for sure, because this is like the meat and potatoes, and I want to know how you built off of the holographic universe and stuff, because that to me is like so interesting. So Amy read your book, and I know she does like business coaching, and it looks like a lot of alignment work grounded in spirituality. But she reached out to you and said, "Hey, I like what you're doing here."
basically.
Yeah.
You know, she said, you're smart, you're incredibly good looking, you're witty, and you know.
Oh my gosh.
No, I'm being facetious. I'm being facetious. But she did reach out. She liked the book. And then, you know, we ended up connecting. We were actually both living in Perth at the time. And I was born and raised in Sydney. I had hopped from Sydney down to Melbourne for a couple of years and then over to Perth, which is Western Australia. It's the most isolated city in the world, if you don't know. And she was born and raised there. So she was there at the time. And at the time I was about to approaching leaving or ending a relationship, and she was doing the same, and she was about to basically wipe her entire life slate clean. And as it happened, we didn't intend this or plan it, but we both moved from Perth over to Sydney in basically at the same time in parallel to each other. And from there, we actually, because we were communicating over good old Facebook, we ended up being able to connect and meet in person. And, you know, it was like sort of like as soon as I met her, you know, it was kind of like, oh, yeah, this game over.
You felt the chemistry. Yeah.
Yeah, it was instant. It was like I've never had any doubt that she is, you know, she's the one for me in this life for sure.
That's amazing. Wow, wow, wow. I didn't realize there was this romance involved. That's awesome. yeah. Well, that's awesome. So, you know, and also Australia. I am so, every time, like, I'm talking to you, I talk to so many people that are from Australia on the show. I probably have had, you know, I've had some people from all over the world, but a fair amount of people that are in the spirituality and consciousness movement are in Australia. And I just keep thinking, like, is Australia what Los Angeles spirituality is pretending to be? Like, I kind of feel like it is in some ways. You are all, and I don't know if it's the Hopi. I mean, I know some of the people that I've had on, Stephen and Evan Strong, Paul Anthony Wallace, these are people that are very immersed in indigenous cultures and the extraterrestrial stuff, which is totally all about consciousness. But I don't know, there is something going on over there. Do you feel that way? Do you feel like it's a very, you live in a very spiritual area?
I think the region we were in, like, I'm good mates with Stephen Evan. And oh, we're kind awesome. Of like, we're kind of colleagues in a way. We've done some live, you know, webinars and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, in that region where we were living, like Stephen Evan lived in the same general area, it's called the Byron Bay Shire or the Byron Shire. And it is notorious or renowned, depending on your point of view, for being that kind of an area. It is the most kind of awake region in the country, I think. And it's, you know, the least jabbed region in the country. It's you know, there's a lot of things going for it. There's a lot of pretending and posing as well. Don't
get
me wrong.
Right.
You know, it's part of the course, right? It comes with the territory. But yeah, I think it's a pretty good place to live if you're going to be in Australia.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. Now, I just love the Australian thing that keeps serendipitously happening on my show and makes me going like, is it serendipitous? Am I due to go over there and see what's going on? Like, there's something about your country. Yeah, it's awesome. Okay, but that said, so let's see. I guess the question then is this. What did you really like? What 10 years into your awakening, what do you think it was that got you to go, whoa, I have an understanding about the universe now, or at least my own reflections on it that I'm going to just drill out volume one of this book. How did you get there, Brendan?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there's nothing glamorous about a story like that.
Right.
You know, it's the life of the hermit. And I had that experience with the holographic universe, which started it. And then I moved to Melbourne and I spent, by the time I was 24, I think I moved to Melbourne when I was 23. By the time I was 24, I had started actually putting material together. So I spent 4 years at that point. I was 4 years reading and highlighting and making notes in the books and things. And then I started 4 years into it. I was like, okay, I'm going to put material together. I didn't have a clear idea of what I was going to do. And so that's not a good way to start, folks, if you're going to write a book.
So, right.
Yep. Words of the wise. And so, you know, as a result, you know, I just kept journeying down this path of, you know, kind of like obsessive research and investigation. And I knew I think it was always going to happen. It was inevitable. I felt like compelled, like I didn't even feel like I owned my life. You know, it was like this mission kind of overtakes you and you become a man possessed because you've got this realization that you want to share in your own way and help people to, you know, be able to share in that because you know the value of it for yourself. And the transformative potential that that kind of insight has for us collectively. And so that was it. And I spent 5 to 6 years kind of working full time on that research and writing, you know, like 7 to 12 hours a day. And the end result was the first installment. I finally whittled it down. I wrote like 7-8 books worth of material. And I finally realized, okay, here's book one. And so I worked on that and I finished it off. And that was the first installment that was published in 2012. So I've got book two now, which is all a massive book. It's slightly bigger. I need to shave some off of it. It's part two. It's technically they're the same book, but it's a very, very deep dive into some very interesting areas. I'm actually going to be very excited when it's available.
Yeah. What do you think? Are we thinking like 2023, this year or beyond that?
I'm looking at next year. I think by the time next year is rolling around, it'll be ripe. This year is kind of like the 10-year anniversary of book one. So I might just do like a revised edition and put that out again. But 2023 is going to be like, this book is something, to me, it's something special. And it's like a level of perspective that's very hard to come by. So, you know, I don't want to keep it hidden away for too much longer. I'm very keen to get it out, but I don't think now's the right time at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so look, here's what I want to get into then. This book has a lot of interesting, I mean, some of the, you've got a lot of hooks that draw me into being like, oh, I got to check out this book. For instance, I mean, what is, there's an occult connection to contemporary science. That it seems that most people don't even realize. Can you go into a little bit about that?
Yeah, specifically, I devoted chapter 6 to that, and it's a very interesting investigation, and it's been done around the world going back centuries. But basically, the clairvoyant investigation of subatomic matter and what that looked like, and so I focus more on a theosophist. Couple, they were a working couple, Charles Liebeder and Annie Besant. And what they did was they started in the late 1800s investigating using clairvoyance, the faculty of clairvoyance to view subatomic particles. And it basically, they, if you read their book, Occult Chemistry, it's very interesting, very, very thorough. They went into massive detail. They drew in very fine detail what they were seeing clairvoyantly. And the upshot of it was that along came a physicist many years later by the name of Stephen Phillips, who took an interest in their work. And he was a guy who was a string theorist. So this guy's got like massive credibility and knowledge in this realm. So yeah. he's very well positioned to assess their work, right? These two occultists, and see what they said and whether there was anything to it. Because, of course, the entire scientific community shuns that kind of thing, right? But this guy, Stephen Phillips, comes along and he basically does an investigation of their work and says it's accurate. What they've done, what they've depicted is what string theorists call strings and what we are calling quarks and subquarks. So the most fundamental constituents of matter as drawn by these occultists in the late 1800s, early 1900s, turns out to be basically picture-perfect depictions of strings in terms of string theory, quarks and subquarks. These are, you can't get any more fundamental as far as the constituents of matter goes. And one of the interesting things that comes out of it is that they not only were right about a lot of those things, but they were wrong on something important too, but I'll get to that. But the matter that they were depicting is essentially actually nothing. It's emptiness. It's the fabric of space. Basically, if you imagine space as water, like if we're a fish in a tank, right, and you imagine the fish blows a bubble, that bubble is actually matter, but it's emptiness. It's the fabric of space or the water pushed out and expanded into an emptiness. And that's actually what matter fundamentally is. And they, interestingly, they thought they were looking at atoms, but Phillips realized they were looking at two atoms at that level, at that scale, and at the atomic scale, they were looking at two atoms that were seemingly fused together or connected. And they didn't, as occultists using clairvoyance, they didn't have a way of testing or verifying this stuff. He did that. So he realized, oh, okay, the numbers they're giving us add up. Like they're counting these particles and the strings, and it's all adding up more or less. But that little insight there, he helped clarify what they're actually seeing. And it's astonishing. I mean, this was decades before they even started to theorize about strings being the fundamental constituents of matter.
Yeah. So what makes you believe that it's not, and again, this is just me playing the devil's advocate, but I want to know, because I intuitively I'm going, yeah, people knew a lot back then, and we don't talk about it enough. But what makes you believe that it wasn't just like, you know, a bunch of people like, you know, high in a dorm room postulating about like how the world works, and then later you look at the science and you're like, oh, it's right. Is it the actual numbers? Were there measurements? Were there just things that there's no other way that it could have been verified except by like this? I guess I'm trying to bridge the line between like occult and like verifiable fact, which is kind of hard to do, but yeah, I'm curious why you give it so much credence.
Yeah, I mean, they couldn't, they had no way of verifying it for themselves. I think Stephen Phillips came along and did it using what was available to him as a physicist and his knowledge. So it's like, okay, like this guy is in a position to actually assess this work. He's an expert in physics and strings, string theory. It's a very compelling case. And the amount of detail that Leadbeater and Besson supplied was astonishing. I mean, it was a massive amount of detail. So it's like, even if they were just, you know, a couple of teenagers getting high in their dorm room or whatever, does that make it less astonishing that they were so on point?
Right. No, that's a good point. It's a very good point. Yeah. So that's interesting. That is interesting. And, you know, it's not the first time that people that are, I mean, look at Jack Parsons in the NASA program, even, you know, Isaac Newton and I mean, all these great thinkers were alchemists first, right? These are the scientists. The scientists have a deep history in the occult practices. But I'm very fascinated by Phillips and the research that you've been bringing on, because it just makes it more substantive that our current understanding of reality has an occult root. What other examples are there in your synthesis that make you believe that, like, yeah, look at the spiritual stuff. They knew a lot more.
I think I just want to add also Edwin Babbitt. I found out later Edwin Babbitt was a guy in the 1800s who had done that investigation. And I think that apparently Leadbeater and Besson were partially basing their work off of his clairvoyant investigation. So that's something.
Wow.
I just wanted to note that for anyone out there who might have actually known that. But yeah, so I think it's more the conceptual ties, and in the scientific realm, we get these theories and these models that they build, and they go, okay, well, here's what the evidence tells us, and here's what we can extrapolate from that to build a model of what's possible. And the model of what's possible in the world of contemporary science, at least in the realm where they're actually willing to deal with the awkward, uncomfortable material, matches up so beautifully with what we've known for centuries and millennia in the realm of the occult. I mean, it's all it does is it builds that bridge of, well, here we go. Now we have a better understanding of the mechanisms. Now we have a better understanding of what drives this phenomena at a ground level. And so, you know, for people who are of that turn of mind, it's like now when you see the two connected, it's like undeniable. Like on the one hand, we have all this evidence, we have all this experience. It's a totally empirical thing that we've got this, like millions of people around the world who've had all sorts of experiences that supposedly shouldn't happen in the realm of, in the thinking of mainstream science, but they do happen. And then we have the conceptual understanding of it over here, which lends it a massive amount of credibility. And it's like, well, when you see the two combined, I mean, you'd have to be the most closed-minded, rigidly, you know, pathologically rigid human to then just stand in denial of this. I mean, I think it's extremely at the very least, extremely interesting.
Yeah, no, I like that. And I like that that's a great philosophical position to have on it. It's interesting. I mean, that's kind of my thoughts on it as well. That, you know, we have to be open to having our deepest beliefs challenged, because it's that is evolution. And I wondering, you know, Brendan, when it comes to pathology, I love that you use that, pathologically rigid. That's hilarious. Because yeah, I mean, that's the flip side, right? I get it all the time from people that hear about this show, that hear about the topics that interest me. They're going, yeah, but those people are deluded, right? The psychics, the UFO believers, yeah, there's like something happened to there. I had someone on, and you know, someone said to me, is it just because like they must have had a traumatic incident with a parent, and then they created this story about a UFO coming in and making contact, and I'm going, yeah, that has been what the scientific community has been saying about that. Why do you laugh at that example? What makes you go, yeah, that's so that can't be what it is?
I mean, it's just like, yeah, you know, you couldn't come up with a more shallow kind of a rationale. It's like, oh, you want to play in the kiddies pool forever. Okay, well, you do that. You know, it's like, I actually, you just reminded me of a thread going on social media. I just put out a short video, 12 signs of entity attachment, right? So spirit attachment or possession or whatever you want to call it. And one of the comments I got back was from a guy who was genuinely like curious and open-minded, but obviously, you know, doesn't have the knowledge yet. And he was sort of saying, well, isn't this kind of a matter of, you know, belief, like people believing them, like convincing themselves that there's something there when probably there's not. And there's that's a prevailing mentality. Like that's the classic kind of reductionist mainstream scientific mentality. And, you know, I told him, well, we have an idea with some of this in book one. We actually have technology now that shows us attached entities, attached spirits, discarnate beings, spirit beings. We can see this now. So if the people are hallucinating, the equipment is hallucinating with them.
Right. That's interesting. Very interesting. So, okay. Yeah, no, that's fascinated, the equipment piece. Yeah. I mean, and for a synthesis that is so, I mean, laying down a foundation for a scientifically based spiritual paradigm, you know, what kind of, what is the book made up of? Is it just example after example? Are you kind of building off of like previous understanding from one chapter to the next? How do you relate this overall theoretical framework?
Yeah, it's kind of I put it together in terms of a structure. I wanted a structure that would walk people through the philosophical kind of, okay, here's where we're at, here's where we've been, this is where we're going, here's some of the attitudinal issues that we come up against in this world. And, you know, that's like chapters 1 and 2. And then, you know, the problems with the scientific realm and the way that science often is blocked by people who are unwilling to look at evidence, people who are engaging in censorship and the suppression of evidence. And that's sort of chapters 1, 2, and 3 covered. And then chapter 4 goes into the quantum physics foundation, which I think is very important because it speaks to the paranormal stuff. And then you have that, that's your sort of scientific framework. And then chapter 5 goes from the quantum weirdness into mystical experience, which is, again, this is a mirror of my journey, right? I get the foundation in theory from Michael Talbot, then I have mystical experiences. So I'm going, okay, this leads to this, leads to this. So I'm walking people in a structured way that's designed to actually facilitate this sort of transformation of consciousness that I went through but reading a book.
That's awesome.
So it's structured to get, it sort of intentionally gets more and more out there as it goes along. And then book 2, it's like, you know, a whole other beast.
Oh my gosh, yeah. How much more is there? Like, does this understanding, does it deepen? Do you know more? Do you learn more about yourself? Like, I'm curious, you know, to get as much as you have in book 1 and have as much praise as you have for it. And we're going to link everybody to this so they can pick up the book from your website. I mean, it's you can get it on Amazon. You can read the reviews on Amazon. They're amazing. But also just follow any of Brendan's stuff and you'll see that, you know, people are resonating with this illusion message. But yeah, I'm very curious always, you know, without how are you able to get another long book out of it without feeling like, oh gosh, didn't I cover all this in book one? I'm just repeating myself at this point. You know, I'm curious.
Oh, but there's so much to talk about, man.
I guess that's true. That's fair. That's fair. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, there are some really interesting threads that were, you know, I've been pulling on for book two that were touched on, or, you know, we covered it to some extent or alluded to it in book one, but book two is like, okay, these threads, I'm going to pull on these now, and I'm going to basically show you a level of perspective that you're not going to be able to find anywhere else in dealing with this kind of subject matter. So that was kind of the intention of it. And, you know, I think that because it's such a, I have such a, my mindset is to be syncretic and to make links between things so that it's like layering understanding on top of understanding to give you something that is like not 2 + 2, but, you know, 2 cubed, like, you know, to give you like a non-linear exponential perspective increase. And that's sort of my goal. So, I find the, sorry, man, go ahead.
No, that's trance inducing, which I love. That put me in an altered state. Keep going. So, a multidimensional, I don't even know what you said, and that's how trance inducing it was, but it took me somewhere. A non-linear understanding.
Yeah. And, it's one of those things where, you know, cause I don't just like to repeat stories or just tell a story. Like I'm looking to derive a deeper meaning out of something and to build a perspective. Cause we have this kind of perspective available. You know, there's general outlooks as to what's possible and what's happening. And I'm building my version of, okay, here's what's possible. Here's what's happening. Here's some of the evidence for it. Here's what we're actually experiencing here. But, you know, have you considered seeing it this way? Have you considered seeing it this way? And that's where I'm a bit different. You know, I'm not just repeating material that's already floating around. I'm giving a level of interpretation and meaning to things.
Have you found the grand unified theory of the universe?
That's not really my job.
Okay, fair enough. No, I mean, look, I know everybody talks about that, like the whole Stephen Hawking and the physicist. It's the pipe dream. It's the Holy Grail, mapping out a formula for everything.
And then some people keep trying to do it without dealing with consciousness, so they're never going to get there.
That's what I was going to say. I'm saying, isn't it just consciousness? Can we just put that on a whiteboard and say, this is it right here, the word, capital C? But no, it's very interesting that I agree that coming at it from different levels, what I also find interesting, even just looking through the chapters here, is that it looks like you are bridging things between the gaps, because I think that's an issue in spirituality, at least for me, is this, you know, I think I watched a whole documentary once on torsion fields and that kind of like, I don't even know if it was a torsion. It was like that, the vortex, kind of like the shape that has like the upside. What is that called? Where it's like the V shape up, V shape down, and it's kind of like energy circling through that.
Yeah. That's a torsion field.
Yeah. So it's a whole documentary about how that's the secret to everything in the universe. And then once you know what the bleep do you know and the secret and all this stuff, and they're talking about sending intention and all this stuff, and then you hear about Tesla and vortex math, then you hear, well, the pyramids are the key to the universe, and it's like they're all these holograph. We're all a hologram, and it's like everybody has a different little piece of this. And for me to see this book where you are bridging the occult and torsion and, you know, New Age spirituality and contemporary spirituality and old school and all this stuff, I feel like is it's great to have that synthesis. It's great to at least have one person that has taken all these things and brought that together. Was that something that you are conscious of, or that you notice in the spiritual community, that some people get like really hopped up on pyramids and you're going, yeah, but what about this piece over here?
There's a lot of that kind of thing, I think, in the spiritual community and the world in general, because people get they get the blinkers on and they get kind of hypnotically focused on something to the exclusion of everything else. I'm sort of, one of my jobs, I guess, is to help people break down the hypnotic trances and break down, you know, take the blinkers off and go, well, if you see it from this angle, or if you see it through this other lens, over from over here at a new vantage point, you're going to see something that you've never seen before. So yeah, it's an intentional, it's definitely intentional on my part for sure.
Yeah. What do you think people who might are well versed in, or at least say they're well versed, you know, like people that go to retreats and you know, get their chakras cleansed and have like a base root understanding of spirituality, do you think there's anything they read in your book that they walk away from going, whoa, I've never thought about it this way before?
Yeah, I've had a number of people who have done a lot of reading, you know, over decades. You know, I had one guy say, you know, I've been reading this stuff for 40 years and yours was the best book that I've ever read. Like that kind of of sentiment from people who are quite well-versed in this world is, you know, I get that quite a bit because they have spent time building up a level of perspective so they can appreciate what I've done from a, you know, as opposed to someone who's a newbie who comes in and goes like, oh, it's all new. And they're kind of like processing all this stuff. They don't have a reference point for anything. And then they're going to be blown away because I'm giving them a download of perspective. But then the people who've been in the realm for a while, they appreciate it on a whole other level.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think it is? Is it just the way you've brought all these different fields together? Is it an aspect of spiritual? I mean, I you know, I love when people go like really hermetic, like when I see people referencing these like old grimoires and these books that I'm like, I don't even know what's in these books. It looks like spells and things like this, but clearly they were important in culture. And a lot of us are focusing a lot more time on Eckhart Tolle and The Secret than like these old books you might find in a used bookstore that you have no idea about. Even Aleister Crowley is a little pop compared to how much has been written in the occult. You know, I'm curious about what aspects of spirituality that you feel. I mean, you gave me the chemistry example. That's amazing. Is there anything else that you've delved into that you feel like you haven't seen as much about that you're bringing to the synthesis?
One of the things that there's not a lot of perspective on is the collective psyche of humanity and the collective unconscious. And, you know, obviously, you know, Carl Jung was the maestro of that realm. But he's, you know, he's been dead for 61 years now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of my interests is, and I have a guy, a friend who I think of as a colleague over in the UK, Nick Sandbrook, who's also very much on this track, and helping people to see our relationship with this entity that is the collective human unconscious and the way that operates, the dynamics of that relationship, because we're in a relationship with this thing that is not just a passive repository of information. It's actually like a living being, and it kind of is like a child in the way that it operates or thinks. And that's a very, very fairly esoteric perspective. It's not a well understood perspective at all. And so I've seen a lacuna there that needs kind of a lot of attention. And so that's, you'll see in book two, I go more in that direction. And in book three, I'm considering, you know, just an all-out exposition on that kind of theme.
He's going to be in book three too? Holy crap, man. That's amazing. Oh,
it's coming, man. Don't worry.
No, I mean, that's very interesting. And especially in light, I'm curious what your perspective is on this, on the way freedom represents or connects to the collective unconscious. Because in general, I mean, I think that's like the kind of paradoxical push and pull that I definitely am intrigued by and read about a lot more. Because on the one hand, it's great to be like, we all are one and Gaia and one Earth. And then it's like, yeah, but some of those people, I mean, I posted something about this once because I kind of feel it's true. It's like, yeah, but then if we're all one, where's personality? Where's the intrigue? Where's the freedom, the individuating, which Carl Jung is all about? So I am curious. I mean, what is your quick synopsis of the way the freedom of the individual relates to either this source consciousness idea and or collective unconscious? Because I know those could be two different things.
Yeah, I think that the individual is, well, in terms of humanity, we are going through a phase of evolution where the job, if you like, or one of the jobs is to actually master the individuation process. So we, you know, you can still be recognize that we are all one and all connected to the same basic foundational reality, the same source, but we can know that without having to homogenize ourselves or be like each other. And I think that it's oneness in diversity that's what makes it interesting, or diversity through oneness. And that's you know, we're not supposed to be like this bunch of mindless kind of collectivists who are, or communists or whatever. You know, we're supposed to be individuals, because that's the journey that we're on, as these little splinters or fragments or sparks of the source that have come into third density to manifest as individuals. That's an intentional act. So we're supposed to embrace the individuation process and see what we can become of ourselves as individuals, with the awareness that we are also a collective entity at the same time, without losing our individuality in that.
How can the individual embrace the collective unconscious, do you feel like?
Sorry, say again?
How can the individual embrace the collective unconscious? Like, how do you feel like that the collective unconscious then plays a role in the practical life of the individual seeking freedom?
That's a great question. I think that there is a kind of tug of war going on in the collective psyche, because on the one hand, freedom terrifies people and they want to be controlled and they want to be told what to do. And you can see that. I mean, the last 2 years have been a spectacular demonstration of that. Right. You know, without needing to get into it, but it's obvious that a lot of people are not ready to be fully fledged thinking individuals with discernment, discrimination, and awareness, self-awareness. So there's that. There's this tug of war. It's like, I want to be free, but that's scary. And so the collective unconscious is kind of, it operates in a way that helps to keep us kind of hypnotized and mesmerized and distracted and locked into established patterns, established pathways. It's like, you know, we've trod this path for 1,000 years. Why would you change what you're doing now? Just stick with the path, son. And that's kind of, it seems to play this role of, it's like it provides a psychological, psychic inertia that we as individuals then have to, you know, part of the hero's journey is to overcome that, overcome the group mentality, overcome the mob mentality in the herd. So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, because there's a push-pull there. We're a very contradictory group of humans.
No, it's definitely true. And I mean, even this, I've never thought about the term the way some people, you know, jokingly use, like, you're unconscious versus you're unconscious, as, you know, we love saying in hypnosis, I say all the time. But there is kind of the unconscious collective unconscious, which is what you're fighting about, which is, or sort of trying to wake people up to, which is this, you know, oh, well, this is how things are done. But then I feel that there's sometimes, you know, when Jung talked about synchronicity and the collective unconscious, it would be the fact that three different scientists across the globe at the same time landed on similar understandings of life. And I do think with your truth movement, with, you know, people like us being able to podcast and broadcast more throughout the world, there is and also like the Great Resignation. I feel like that people leaving their jobs was like a collective unconscious thing. The idea that you have the Wall Street Journal and these big entities putting articles that say people want to have meaning in their lives now. And it kind of came out of, you know, stuff that the spiritual people have been talking about on the side, going, yeah, no one's happy. No one's happy in their 9-to-5. And then mainstream publications that support the 9-to-5 are now like, oh, I guess we better write about this because everybody's leaving. That to me represents a more positive collective unconscious response than just like, oh, well, we're going to stay drones forever.
Yeah, totally. And it's, that's the thing. It's like change within this matrix is still possible. And it is. It's a funny thing, because it's fickle. It's scared. Like the collective mentality or the collective unconscious mentality is very childlike. So it's looking for reassurance. It's afraid of the unknown. It wants these surrogate parent figures to tell us how to live and what to do, but then that makes us miserable on some level at the same time. So there's always this tug of war. And I agree. It's, you know, that's a positive sign of like a tectonic shift that's happened in the collective psyche, that we are like there's a spark of awareness that's come in and broken through the trance and gone, you know, why am I sitting at this desk here on Wall Street? What is the point of this? Why do I have all this money, but I just sit here at this desk all the time, not spending it in any fun ways? Like, it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't make me feel alive.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely, there's still positive things happening.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, look, I know I'm do you have a little bit more time? I don't mean to take up your time. How much more you got?
No, absolutely, man. All good.
Okay.
Yeah,
this is good. This is good because I am loving this so far. I want to know. I want to know about time. Because yeah, man, I mean, when you start getting into the spiritual stuff, I had my college phase where I was like, whoa, I didn't even have any drugs to think this. One day I was just like, whoa, man, time is an illusion. Here's why. But then your book is saying, well, it's not just an illusion. It's something different. And as somebody that loves time research, you know, you don't have to give away all the good stuff because I want people to pick up this book. And I want to read this book too now, for sure. But really study it. But what is like kind of the broad strokes on the way that you what you've uncovered about our sense of time?
Well, I mean, I think you would be able to relate to this. I mean, basically human physiology, perceptual physiology, is designed to function in a certain way. It apprehends information in a certain way that makes it appear that there is this thing that we call space, and there's distance between objects. And it seems to us that one thing happens and then another thing happens and then another thing happens, and it's serialized and it's all, you know, like pearls on a string. It's like one moment, then another. It's like we have this river of time, you know, it goes in one direction from start to finish, you know, left to right and past to future. And that's how it looks because of the way that the human sort of animal is built. But then when you research or when you have altered states of experience, of consciousness, you start finding out, well, there's a mode of being, or many, many modes of being, where you can experience things simultaneously. You can experience such a vastness and a connectedness and a presence that everything is present here now. You know, I felt galaxies, remote galaxies flowing through me, wow, all simultaneously, you know, and it's like, you can't convey that or put that in words, but it's like, there are these different modes of being to us, available to us, that show us that our perception of time as humans is just one particular way of seeing things. And there are plenty of others that are available even to us, like just through meditation or just through taking an interesting hallucinogen, or, you know, so. Yeah, I don't know if I'm answering your question.
But. Well, so beyond being an illusion, so you wouldn't just say like, oh, time's an illusion. Why?
I would say serialized, the perception of time. It's the perception. And ultimately, you know, it's like Robert Anton Wilson said, oh, yeah, you know, reality is plural and mutable. So it's not just one reality. You know, it's like we have many simultaneous availabilities. We can experience linearity, we can experience simultaneity. We have people who've gone into, you know, near-death experiences who have been able to perceive all of their other alternative lives, the so-called past lives and even future lives, simultaneously, and seeing them all happening at once. And so there are like dimensional perspectives where we can go, oh, it's literally all happening now. And that's not available to us, you know, just operating out of our, you know, the eyes pointing out of the skull kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure, we'll get to the masterclass and evolving yourself, because this is also very curious. But before we do, the grand illusion, you know, I've heard some people say like, it's all an illusion, shatter your illusions, get out of the matrix. And it's kind of like this almost this shaking people waking up kind of way of you know, mentality, and I certainly resonate with it. But when you call it a grand illusion, and your choice to name the book the grand illusion rather than you know, the holosyncretic universe, whatever your end up synthesis is, which I know it's very complex, but why did you lead with that? Why the name Grand Illusion rather than what the universe actually is?
I think it's in the name, it's the title it keeps on giving. You can do a million different things with that title. And
yeah,
and I, you know, so I wanted to keep going and keep writing different books about the illusions that we harbor and, you know, break them down and see things from different perspectives. I think I just liked the title right off the bat. I stuck with it for years before I published it. I was just like, this is what it's going to be called. I don't know why, but I just did. I just liked it. And it's like, well, the grand illusion. I mean, it is, it's a pretty amazing, spectacular illusion. Like to think that the cosmos or the multiverse is this just basically a dream that we have holographically projected inside of this field of infinite consciousness. And somehow we've injected ourselves into it as these little human avatars having this weird little experience inside of it is pretty amazing.
Totally, totally. I love it. I love it. Yeah. And also, you know, it sounds like a grand illusion is meditation, at least according to your How to Evolve Yourself masterclass. Now, look, I know you're not like completely poo-pooing meditation because we've already talked about closing your eyes and going into altered states. But your free masterclass, I mean, how to evolve yourself without meditation, hard work, or spending thousands. Also very interesting, talking about, you know, beyond epigenetics and a lot of energy healing systems. What do you think about meditation? Why do you not need that in order to evolve, you think?
Well, interestingly, you know, a lot of the most profound and powerful transformative experiences happen in a one-off, like a lightning strike kind of event.
Right.
And, you know, and the classic example is like the near-death experience. You know, people have a very profoundly altered experience of reality, something very deep, and it changes their outlook forever. It transforms them forever. You have instances of people who have had, you know, illnesses, cancers disappear spontaneously after these experiences. Yes. They spontaneously develop amazing healing abilities. They become telepathic. They hear other people's thoughts. I mean, all sorts of stuff happens in that, just that sort of kind of like lightning strike moment. And it's not repeatable, it's not replicable, but it changes people forever. And so that's kind of the thrust of that work. It's like, this isn't about adopting a new practice. It's not about, you know, taking up more time in your day. This is a one-off type of event. We actually do four completely different ones. So they're progressive, they build on each other. They're four transformative events. That's the lens that you kind of look at this through. It's kind of like a quasi-shamanic thing, you know, shamanic initiation type events or alien contact. It shifts people in a way that they, you can never undo. It's irrevocable.
Yeah. I'm drawn to the not having hard work piece.
Yeah, totally.
And I'm like, what? That sounds freeing. I guess I just, let me put it in this perspective because I have, that's often an answer I get from people I've had on the show. I say, you know, why are you so, you know, why do you see angels? Why do you contact aliens? Why do I feel like I've never, or I have had trouble accessing these things? And often the answer is, well, do you have a regular meditation practice? And I'm like, not the formal way. I mean, I listen to a lot of hypnotic tracks and I love going into trance, but like me and myself and really experiencing that has not been something I've dedicated myself to. And yeah, partly because it feels like a lot of hard work. And I guess the skeptic in me is like, will it be worth it? What would you say to someone? What would you say to me, Brendan? And can I access these realms without quote unquote hard work?
I would say if you're looking to do that kind of thing, like that particular type of stuff, I was meditating for the first 2 years of my 20s, you know, multiple times a week. I went to a Chatswood spiritualist church group, trance meditation group. And, you know, I've started to develop clairvoyance. When I stopped going and stopped meditating, it regressed and disappeared. So
it did have benefits for you.
Well, my intention and my goal with it at that time was specifically to develop the power of clairvoyance. So it did what it started to do, what I wanted it to do. It's just that I ended up getting sidetracked with life and not following through down that path. So if you're looking to do that type of stuff, I would say, yeah, you probably want to take up a regular, consistent meditation practice.
Okay, fair enough. Versus, and then evolve. So the kind of work you're doing with the Evolve Masterclass, and also, I imagine it also leads itself into self-gnosis, because I don't see how self-gnosis and esoteric practices can't relate or couldn't possibly relate to evolutionary DNA activation. Like, this is the stuff of self. This is the going internal, which is where we are Please keep moving this way. 5D, let's keep going. But yeah, like this is what we're doing. So what are you, what if it's not clairvoyance, what are we evolving with our DNA activation in some of this other non-meditative work you're doing?
Well, a lot of it, a lot of what I see out there in the world is a lot of people who have, even people who have those skills like clairvoyance or what have you, these, cities, superpowers, they don't necessarily have a high level of embodiment. They don't necessarily embody the truth of who and what we really are. A lot of them have major health deficits. They eat rubbish, all this sort of stuff. Like, so they a lot of it's very common that you have like these blinkers. Again, they just like they've got their one thing that they do and that's it. And they're kind of like, they're like a pale imitation of the human that they could be. So the point of this work is healing. Yes, it's healing, but it's also evolutionary. So it's kind of like to shed your skin, caterpillar, meet your future butterfly self kind of thing. It's like, so the abilities, like those superpowers, can be an attractive distraction. They don't necessarily indicate a high level of evolution. They don't indicate necessarily high self-awareness. Or high self-esteem, so it's like I'm more interested in the inner work and the inner evolutionary, the growth and expansion and the embodiment of, like, you are a spark of God, you are a fragment of the creator, and you should live like that. I want to help people to live like that and to walk like that, like hold your fucking head high. That's what we're supposed to be doing here. And that's the thrust of that work. So evolve yourself is that work with the DNA activation. And then self-gnosis is for someone who wants to maybe work one-on-one with me as a supplementary thing to that. So more one-on-one, intimate, we can nut it out, together and do the inner work on a more intimate playing field.
And for people that are going, well, do I join Truth Social or do I join truth.network or do I join the both? What are you, 'cause I notice on your podcast and a lot of your blog posts, you are tackling, the current climate we're in, the world situation. And, it is, I always find it interesting when people that, will write like a spiritual or have this spiritual grounding, like really are actively engaged in, it's almost like you're taking out your sword and having to like stab the falsehoods in the narrative so you can like get to this evolution work. Is that sort of where truth.network is sitting? Is it all kind of truths? I mean, I know you also had you post about entities and stuff, but I'm curious as to like as a public figure and freedom hacker, what are you hoping that people take away from your podcast as well as the social network?
That's a good question. I think the podcast is really a way of just me highlighting certain things that I think are interesting or important at the time, maybe, and just to help people. Here's a tool that you can use to make your life better. Whereas Truth Network, it was set up in 2018 after Facebook deleted our Facebook page,
Oh
and
no.
that was part of the first major purge that they did. So we've been running that. It's just basically our sort of middle finger to all the big tech platforms, just saying, look,
Yes.
here's a place you guys, if the truth community wants to come here and talk about whatever the hell you want to talk about, you can do it here. There will be no censorship. And that's just the premise of truth. So that's all it is. It's just like a social network. People go into groups, they share in the timeline. That's, I don't really, it's a free for all, do what you want in there. I don't care. There's no censorship. And it's not really necessarily connected to the podcast or, the other work that I do. It was just like because we've been in the truth movement for so long, it was like this situation with censorship needs, we need other options. So we set that up 4 years ago.
So you still feel in, and I know we don't have to get into the nuts and bolts of this because that could get us on a whole nother tangent, but it does seem like you have to do the, it seems in your work there has to be like calling attention to the global health situation, the global political situation, this notion of the deep state. Is it, I know some people can stay in those zones and just get so, I mean, like when you talk about that, you could either like keep it and bring it back to the spiritual and really go there, or you can just be like, an alternative, it could be a conservative talk, quote unquote conservative talk show. But yeah, how do you toe that line? Like, what do you, when you're attacking or taking on the real world issues of today. How do you keep yourself in a place of freedom? Because I'm not even sure I could if I was just mired in headlines like that.
Yeah, well, that's a fair point, because when I see people who are, you know, mired in the headlines, so to speak, they are generally, I would say, pretty stressed out humans. Because how could you not be if you're constantly feeding that into your
psyche? If you go on Rumble and even on BitChute, which I know like you've probably had to go on just because it's more less censored, but when you go on Rumble and these networks, that's one of the criticisms I have. Sometimes I just feel so I've never seen the American flag like as a sign of aggression until I've gone on to like Rumble.com. I'm like, there is negative energy. This does not feel, there are great ideas being brought up in some of these videos. And yeah, you're absolutely right. It seems stressful and overwhelming.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's hard because it's like, you got to be aware. And when you're aware, it's hard to not have your attention diverted back to that constantly, especially now that we're so connected, we've all got 100 different friggin' channels hitting us with this information 24/7. And for me, that's the danger, is, you know, keeping the bigger picture perspective. And, you know, still pulling out the sword and throwing, you know, slashing around a bit, because you need to do, in my opinion, that should be done by as many people as possible. It's like, do your bit to raise awareness so that people have the opportunity to be aware and to make informed choices. And then, you know, come back to the bigger picture and come back to doing your inner work, working on your shadow. Yeah. Because ultimately, if we don't have that inwards evolution, we're going to keep repeating this garbage, you know, endlessly.
I know. It's like, how do you take on the technocracy in the most spiritually conscious way possible? How do we go about? Because you know what? You kind of do have to fight fire with fire. Maybe not. Why do I say that? That's totally not the phrase. You can't fight fire with fire. But it does seem like you do need a strong sword sometimes if you're going to like take down the fact that deep fakes and the algorithm are really messing up our minds. They are.
Oh, yeah.
And the more I talk about love and peace, it's like, yeah, I don't even, everybody just get outside and hug each other. That's what I would say to that. Like, I don't know how many videos you can watch or somebody in power will watch to make a difference. But, you know, it's still something that we need to bring on, because things are evolving in both directions. The one path, the light path, and then this scary tech path, faster than we're even aware of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's it, man. And you know, our strength is in connection with each other and community. And it's like, it's so basic, but that's it. It's, you know, you can't solve the problem by sitting there streaming documentaries 24 hours a day. At some point you have to go and just, you know, talk to your neighbor and grow some vegetables.
Community. That's another word that I've been leaning into a lot more. Yeah. What do you think, how does freedom hacking relate to community, you feel, in your experience?
I mean, community is really, that's where so much of our freedom lies. Like, I know, like, you're aware of this deep state globalist agenda thing that's rolling out, this sort of Leviathan that's gradually taking over the planet. And it's doing so by isolating us from each other and making us feel powerless and weak and alone. And the remedy to that is to be connected to each other, and because that's where we're in our power. And ultimately this whole thing is orchestrated by a handful of people, a handful of sociopaths, and we outnumber them, you know, many, many, many times over. So really, if we band together and use our resources together and use our skills, like put your skill set with my skill set and, you know, the guy next door, and then it's like we start building solutions. And that's where the freedom just to be ourselves and be left alone is huge. Like, most people just want to live. They just want to be left alone. And the system is designed to prevent that from happening. It's designed to impose the conditions of every like minute of every day. Here's how you're going to live. We're going to monitor your stools. Yes. We're going to monitor your light usage, your water usage. We're going to cut you off when you go over the threshold. And it's like,
yes,
all of this stuff is this technocracy that's overtaking us. And it's really the fragmentation and the unawareness that's so much of the fuel for it and enabling it. But if we gather the community, then we can build solutions that we can't build as individuals necessarily.
Yeah. Well, this has been, yeah, I love this. I love this message. I love the way you've synthesized your perspective on it. For more of this, everybody needs to go to BrendanDMurphy.com, which we're going to link to, as well as where you can get the Grand Illusion book. Also, evolveyourself.live, that's truth with truoth.network for the Facebook alternative. As well as, yeah, we'll link to your Instagram, as well as, yeah, there's a lot of content out there that you're bringing to consciousness. The Truth Adverse podcast, Truth Adverse, that's the regular spelling of truth, truth.com. Brendan, before you go, can a freedom hack be as simple as a life hack? As a freedom hacker, normally when we hear hack, we think of, like quick things that can make huge leverage. I think immediately, asking questions of yourself, like, yeah, wait a minute, why am I okay with this thing that I'm paying for? Electric, heat, water, like that's an instant hack. Just go throughout your day and think of the things that are resources and costs and reflecting on that, and that's an instant, like, boom, door opens. But I'm curious, can you leave us with any other very practical hacks that can bring people towards greater freedom?
Oh, I think, Amy, my partner, would probably accuse me of not being the most practically oriented human. So,
Have you been able to hack freedom so well as not being practically oriented? Maybe that's the hack we need.
maybe, yeah. I mean, it definitely helps to have an Amy.
So find a supportive life partner. That's good. That's a great hack.
I mean, for me, it's about knowing who you are, I think, is so many people don't know who they actually are. They don't know what they really want. They don't know what their mission is. They don't know why they're here. And to me, that's like there's a level of freedom that comes with that self-knowledge that only opens up through that doorway. So for me, I've always highly valued self-awareness, the freedom that then comes through, like the doors that open up as a result of knowing who you are and then choosing your unique path as an individual and embracing the so-called hero's journey and walking your path to individuation in your own way, because only you can do it for yourself. No one can do it for you. I mean, that in itself is such a liberating thing. And so self-knowledge is really, I think, at the root of, that's a driving force. That's what drives me in helping people be self-aware at a deeper level. Because I've seen the way that that's opened up, for example, my life. I had someone say to me, who read the book a long time ago, they were like, I was just working this normal job and, just doing the normal thing. And then I read your book and it was like, wow, if this is possible, what the hell am I doing with myself? So that's kind of what drives it. It's like a perspective-based thing for me. And then
Yes.
that's it. And that's really, see, for me, because I'm so zoned in on the perspective and the big picture and that side of things, it's like I sacrifice, the knowing how to function in the real world to a certain extent. there are things that where I'm just like, I try to think of a word for like an ordinary household item every now and then I can't think of it. And it's like, come on, everybody knows what this thing is. And then you go, it's just because I'm not oriented there and my focus is somewhere else so that I can help people to see things that they might not otherwise see. And that's my job, that's my role. So
That's so
I embrace.
beautiful. How
Thank
have you been
you.
so functional? Is it just Amy? Is that the secret? Or is it, have you looked in your life and said, I am, well, this the, I can outsource this to this person. I can outsource this. Like, I guess, yeah, as somebody, I get, now I'm just asking selfishly for myself, but I am curious, as somebody that has always been like, how do people make money in the esoteric? How do you actually build a life that is, because you do have to pay bills, you do have to eat, you do have to survive. But if somebody out there is more inclined to be more big picture and esoteric like you, that's what I'm like, what have you, if it's not Amy, what else can you do so that at the very least bills are getting paid while you're embracing this bigger perspective and self-evolution?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really awesome question. I mean, for us, for me in particular, like trying to figure out how to make this line of, you know, this mission of mine actually be something that can financially sustain me has been an ongoing challenge. I mean,
yeah.
I'm one of the worst case scenarios, I think, in the sense that because my scope is so broad and I go where so many people are not willing to go, and I break down hypnotic trances and all this across different, you know, I'm cross-linking things, and that makes me inherently threatening to a lot of people. And, you know, to anyone who harbors a belief system, I'm by default, I'm threatening. And so it's very difficult walking this path as me, just speaking for myself, it has been very difficult to find a way to make it work. And I've found that putting a toe into the entrepreneurial space and learning how to monetize, you know, social media, learning how to bundle your knowledge or bundle your skills in a way that is in a convenient package that someone can pick up and purchase from you in some format. That's a really valuable skill to have. And you know, speaking of the entrepreneurial world, I'm very blessed to, you know, to have Amy. She's got that brain, she's got that business mind. So she's a business coach. She can really help me. She helps me enormously, and she can help other people. So I'm lucky to have, you know, I call her the Swiss Army knife, because she sort of does everything.
No, and that is, and the point is, yes, like it is, developing the entrepreneurial side, but also the message of, but don't just start a drop shipping store because that's how you make money. You are, by doing the classes, by writing the books, by doing the podcast, you are staying true to who you are. And I, you know, the paradigm shift that you gave me, among many in this episode, was that, the people maybe are a little too obsessed with hacking. Like what you said, freedom hacking. It's not about, it's the old, I'm a human being, not a human doing. It's back to that. It's the ultimate freedom hack is to know thyself more, go deeper into yourself. That's the hack. It's that once you give up on the doing and get more awareness of yourself, then that's the deepest source of freedom, and that's just me reflecting back what you said to me. And I mean, maybe you disagree with that, but it sounds to me that is where you're leading, which I find a lot of freedom in.
Thank you. I appreciate you agreeing with me.
Yes. No, and I appreciate you coming on. This has been amazing. Everybody check out Brendan Murphy. We got the links in the show notes. BrendanDMurphy.com. Thank you so much for coming on. I very much appreciate this conversation. It has been amazing.
Thank you, man. I really had a lot of fun. So I'll do it again anytime. Thanks.
Absolutely. Great. Thanks so much, Brendan. Brendan Murphy already downloaded the book on my Kindle, and so far, it's been a great read. That one's going to keep me in for a while. Then I won't have to, you know, irrationally doom scroll through my Kindle to make sure I still have something to learn. My deepest fears revealed. All right, look, I want to thank Ronnie McGilvery for the theme music. I want to thank you for listening. Let's close this out with the grand void of possibility.